Preface. 25 years ago, Raymond Moody's Life After Life created a worldwide change in our understanding of death. Dr. Moody's research has rippled throughout the world and has helped in no small part to form our modern expectations of what we will experience after death. The tunnel, the white light, the presence of long dead loved ones waiting for us on the other side. Keep in mind that 25 years ago this was not common imagery to associate with the experience of dying. Dr. Moody inspired a first generation of researchers dedicated to a scientific understanding of human consciousness and death, researchers who have in turn created a new science of near-death studies. Bruce Grayson, professor of psychiatry at the University of Virginia, has said that a whole new world opened up following the publication of Moody's research. This change in our collective worldview has been so profound that it is hard to remember the cultural conditions that existed before 1975, when the book was first published. Prior to the publication of Life After Life, the term near-death experience did not even exist. Physicians called it the Lazarus syndrome, implying that it was the result of medical pathology. Patients didn't call near-death experiences anything, often thinking that they were mentally ill or had hallucinations from drugs or a lack of oxygen to the brain. Once Dr. Moody took the time to actually listen to people who had survived heart attacks and so learned about their near-death experiences, our society had a sort of collective aha and began to realize that something very spiritual happens to us when we die. Although George Gallup has estimated that 5% of the general population has had a near-death experience, people were afraid to talk about them for fear of being ridiculed. Far too often they themselves doubted the validity of what had happened to them. Life After Life was hugely successful because it addressed two major problems in 20th century Western civilization. 1. The loss of collective societal myths having to do with death and dying, and 2. The systematic devaluation of anything to do with the spiritual side of humans. Dr. Moody's work reminded us that we are at our very core spiritual beings, and the fact that a loving light greets us when we die is proof of that. When we die, our own lives are evaluated and interpreted not according to how much money we made or our status and prestige, but according to the love we shared with others throughout our life. At a time when church attendance and participation in the traditional organized religions was reaching an all-time low, Life After Life rekindled an understanding of the importance of spirituality in our daily lives. It is fitting that Life After Life was originally introduced by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, the pioneering researcher on death and dying. Although for tens of thousands of years humans accepted death as a natural part of life, a brutal revolution in our attitudes concerning death occurred at the turn of the last century. Death became unnatural, dirty, medicalized, and hidden from the public view. Whereas most people died at home in the 1800s, by the mid-20th century most people died in hospitals. The aggressive end-of-life interventions medical science made possible resulted in the dying person giving up dignity and control over his or her life. By the latter part of the 1900s, even the American Medical Association concluded that dying patients were subjected to humiliating and unnecessary medical interventions that robbed the dying process of any dignity. In 1965, when Elizabeth Kubler-Ross wrote her book on death and dying, death was something that was not discussed. Dying patients were subjected to the loving lie. They were not told the truth about their medical situation, as others felt that the truth was too traumatic and would rob them of hope. Social scientists have, of course, documented that dying patients always knew they were going to die anyway. The loving lie only served to insulate the medical profession and society from the facts of death. Dr. Kubler-Ross dared to actually talk to dying patients about their feelings. This generated enormous hostility from the medical staff at a hospital in Chicago. For example, one nurse angrily asked her if she enjoyed telling patients they had only a few weeks to live. Dr. Kubler-Ross found out that such patients already knew they had only a few weeks to live and were suffering from the loneliness and isolation that our societal fear of death caused them. Although Dr. Kubler-Ross has gone on to make her own contributions to the spiritual understanding of what happens when we die, In her first book, she discussed only the emotional stages of death. These included denial, isolation, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. Our society was astonished to learn even these common sense observations. Establishing that dying people had any feelings at all seemed to anger and outrage a healthcare establishment dedicated to saving lives, not facilitating death. In the mid-60s, although there was a sexual and political revolution in the United States, death as a topic was not discussed, and dying visions and deathbed spirituality as topics were forbidden. It took another decade before the climate was ready for life after life. Dr. Kubler-Ross had introduced the shocking concept that dying people had predictable feelings about death and often even accepted it. 10 years later, Dr. Moody explained why. Instead of death simply being the extinction of life, he documented that it is a spiritually dynamic time with life-transforming insights. These same insights have transformed our society as well. One indicator of the impact of life after life is the enormous number of books with similar titles that followed it. These include Life Before Life, Life at Death, Life Between Life, and my favorite, Elvis After Death. Life After Life has become a cultural icon because it responded to the spiritual impoverishment of our society at the time. It is ironic that the same medical technology that contributed to the degrading and humiliating conditions of dying patients allowed us to successfully resuscitate people so that they could report their near-death experiences. By the early 1970s, medical technology had advanced to the point where successful resuscitation from cardiac arrest was commonplace. Although there have always been stories describing a life after death, prior to the modern era it was rare to survive clinical death. Modern intensive care medicine and rapid response medic teams have made the cheating of death routine. Dr. Moody was the first to recognize that these same patients could contribute to our understanding of the last few minutes of life. Dr. Moody's influence on the first, and now a second, generation of scientists was just as important as the book itself. 1,000 years ago, a book such as Life After Life would not have been needed, as everyone was familiar with the spiritual aspects of dying. In 1975, it was not enough to document that the dying have visions of another life, it was also necessary to prove that these visions were real and not simply hallucinations of the dying mind. 25 years later, virtually every conscious researcher and medical scientist in this field agrees that these experiences are a real and natural part of the dying process. The first generation of near-death researchers included Dr. Ken Ring, professor of psychology at the University of Connecticut, Dr. Bruce Grayson, professor of psychiatry at the University of Virginia, and neuropsychiatrist Peter Fenwick of the British Royal College of Psychiatrists. They used formal scientific investigative techniques and essentially reached the same conclusions as Dr. Moody. These and numerous other researchers documented that the experiences are real, not the result of hallucinations or brain pathology. Their work led in turn to a second generation of scientists such as myself. We did a controlled clinical study of near-death experiences in children at Seattle Children's Hospital and again documented that these experiences are a real part of the dying process and not caused by drugs or a lack of oxygen to the brain. These children, too young to fear death or to know what a near-death experience is, told the same stories as the adults tell in Life After Life. Even more significantly, Dr. James Winery of the National Warfare Institute developed an experimental technique in which near-death experiences could be induced in a controlled environment. He studied fighter pilots who were brought to the point of near-death by being placed in a gigantic centrifuge. The purpose of his study was to understand the forces that fighter pilots are subjected to while flying high-speed jets. He also learned that these same fighter pilots had near-death experiences when subjected to the stresses of the centrifuge. It is fascinating to realize that Dr. Moody, a psychiatrist from Georgia, Dr. Winery, a flight surgeon for the Air Force, and I, a pediatrician from Seattle, each working independently, reached the same conclusions about near-death experiences. When Dr. Moody's book was first published, Medical scientists laughed and dismissed near-death experiences as hallucinations. 25 years later, science is on Dr. Moody's side. I do not know of a single mainstream scientific researcher who has not reached similar conclusions. There have been three major reviews of near-death experiences in the scientific literature of the past 7 years, and all agree with Dr. Moody's initial findings. The skeptics and hostile intellectual climate that pioneers such as Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and Raymond Moody had to endure have now led to the current situation in which there are dozens of articles in mainstream scientific journals on near-death experiences. Dr. Moody has created the current climate where hundreds of graduate students are getting their advanced degrees studying near-death experiences. More than half of the medical schools in the country now teach courses on the spiritual aspects of dying. Today, no one has to feel ridiculed or mentally ill simply because they have been fortunate enough to have had a near-death experience. Life After Life documented that near-death experiences can positively transform those who have them. The inner anger and type A personalities that lead to heart attacks in the first place seem to melt away from exposure to the spiritual light they see at death. The International Association of Near-Death Studies, IANS, an organization dedicated to counseling and support for persons who have had the experience, took these experiences, and that message, and built an international organization that has contributed to the transformation of our society. IANS actively contributes to and encourages scientific research. There are hundreds of IANS chapters in the United States and hundreds more worldwide. Again, it was Raymond Moody and Life After Life that directly resulted in the formation of this organization. Raymond Moody himself has remained a pioneer for the past 25 years. Usually scientists who make the sort of extraordinary contribution he made with Life After Life rest on their laurels, spending the rest of their career refining and promoting their original insights. And while Dr. Moody has deservedly been rewarded with the Bigelow Chair of Consciousness Studies at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and certainly does a bit of that, he also teaches courses for graduate students and freshmen on near-death experiences and on what is known scientifically about life after death. But Dr. Moody's career since Life After Life has primarily been marked by continued explorations into consciousness research. He remains on the cutting edge of scientific research and will always be about 25 years ahead of the rest of us. In 1995, for example, he developed a technique for inducing the near-death experience without actually having to come close to death. He uses the technique to facilitate the ability to contact dead relatives and loved ones. While researching the origins of the near-death experience in ancient Greece, Dr. Moody rediscovered the use of a meditative chamber called the psychomantium that ancient Greek physicians used successfully in their healing rituals. He built his own theater of the mind, as he called his modern psychomantium, and successfully tested it in hundreds of clinical trials. There are now more than a dozen operating psychomantiums in the United States. The psychomantium has even been independently discovered by Russian physicist Ivan Dmitrov and successfully used by Russian psychiatrist Olga Karatidi to induce out-of-body perceptions and past life experiences. Since his rediscovery of the psychomantium, Dr. Moody has continued to explore ways to harness the power of the near-death experience in our daily lives. He once asked me, "Why should we wait until we die to have this remarkably transformative experience?" He is currently working on methods of inducing the experience through specific meditative techniques that do not require the specialized equipment of the psychomantium. Intriguingly enough, humor is often an important part of his current research in understanding and inducing spiritual experiences. On a personal note, Dr. Moody is directly responsible for any contributions that I have made in near-death research. I first met Dr. Moody when I was doing a fellowship in brain research at the University of Washington. I was primarily interested in the effects of radiation and anti-cancer drugs on the brain. I had just published an article on near-death experiences in children based on cases I encountered when I was moonlighting as a critical care physician. Our research team at Seattle Children's Hospital saw near-death research as an interesting sidelight to our otherwise busy medical careers. I had no long-term interest in the field and mostly published my first papers on near-death studies simply to get another solid scientific paper on my resume. I considered the experiences to be fascinomas, meaning they were interesting but ultimately of no importance. My meeting with Dr. Moody changed all of that. He had read my initial papers on children's near-death experiences and wanted to meet me. We spent 3 straight days talking non-stop about near-death experiences. I vividly remember being called to the hospital to resuscitate a critically injured patient during this time period. Dr. Moody accompanied me to the hospital and we continued our discussion at whatever breaks in the action that came while I was attending to the patient, and then all the way home again. He inspired me to think critically about the experiences and their implication for understanding the nature of human consciousness. The fact that dying comatose brains can be conscious and aware of their surroundings, as well as interact with another spiritual reality, has profound implications for our understanding of how the human brain works. He predicted that my near-death research would make my reputation as a neuroscientist, not the promising cancer research I was so involved in at the time. Joseph Campbell wrote that the image of death is the beginning of mythology. In turn, it is our myths that make us feel part of the society of the living, as well as heir to the legacy of the dead who came long before we were here and will be here long after we are gone. Humankind's myths give meaning to individual lives and help us to interpret events, such as death, that cannot be readily understood by normal means. Modern society had abandoned the traditional relationship between death and society that had existed for tens of thousands of years. Even modern funeral practices reflect this, with the advent of the irrational embalming of the dead, which only began about 100 years ago. Our society suffers from our lack of connection to each other and our collective lack of meaning in our lives. Homelessness, depression, drug abuse, alcoholism, road rage, and gun violence all have at their roots a lack of spiritual wisdom. Raymond Moody's Life After Life reconnected us with a timeless wisdom about death. We do not simply die, death is far more complicated than that. We die conscious, with an expanded awareness of this reality coupled with a greater understanding of our lives. By understanding near-death experiences, we connect ourselves with the wisdom of the tribal shamans, the insights of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and the origins of the great religions of the world. Dr. Moody's Life After Life reconnects us with our own spirituality, lying dormant within us. His book gives us the spiritual tools to understand our own lives. It is a timeless book, one that will be just as vital 25 years from now as it was 25 years ago. Melvin Morse, MD Foreword. I have had the privilege of reading the pre-publication copy of Dr. Moody's Life After Life, and I am delighted that this young scholar has the courage to put his findings together and make this new type of research available to the general public. Since I have worked with terminally ill patients over the last 2 decades, I have become more and more preoccupied with looking into the phenomena of death itself. We have learned a lot about the process of dying, but we still have many questions with regard to the moment of death and to the experience our patients have when they are pronounced medically dead. It is research such as Dr. Moody presents in his book that will enlighten many and will confirm what we have been taught for 2,000 years that there is life after death. Though he does not claim to have studied death itself, it is evident from his findings that the dying patient continues to have a conscious awareness of his environment after being pronounced clinically dead. This very much coincides with my own research, which has used the accounts of patients who have died and made a comeback, totally against our expectations and often to the surprise of some highly sophisticated, well-known and certainly accomplished physicians. All of these patients have experienced a floating out of their physical bodies, associated with a great sense of peace and wholeness. Most were aware of another person who helped them in their transition to another plane of existence. Most were greeted by loved ones who had died before them, or by a religious figure who was significant in their life and who coincided, naturally, with their own religious beliefs. It is enlightening to read Dr. Moody's book at the time when I am ready to put my own research findings on paper. Dr. Moody will have to be prepared for a lot of criticism, mainly from two areas. There will be members of the clergy who will be upset by anyone who dares to do research in an area which is supposed to be taboo. Some religious representatives of a denominational church have already expressed their criticism of studies like this. One priest referred to it as selling cheap grace. Others simply felt that the question of life after death should remain an issue of blind faith and should not be questioned by anyone. The second group of people that Dr. Moody can expect to respond to his book with concern are scientists and physicians who regard this kind of study as unscientific. I think we have reached an era of transition in our society. We have to have the courage to open new doors and admit that our present-day scientific tools are inadequate for many of these new investigations. I think that this book will open these new doors for people who can have an open mind, and it will give them hope and courage to evaluate new areas of research. They will know that this account of Dr. Moody's findings is true, because it is written by a genuine and honest investigator. It is also corroborated by my own research and by the findings of other very serious-minded scientists, scholars and members of the clergy who have had the courage to investigate in this new field of research in the hope of helping those who need to know, rather than to believe. I recommend this book to anyone with an open mind, and I congratulate Dr. Moody for the courage to put his findings into print. Elizabeth Kubler Ross, M.D. Flossmoor, Illinois. Introduction. This book, written as it is by a human being, naturally reflects the background, opinions and prejudices of its author. So, although I have tried to be as objective and straightforward as I can, certain facts about me might be useful in evaluating some of the extraordinary claims which are made in what follows. First of all, I have never been close to death myself, so I am not giving a first-hand account of experiences which I have had myself. At the same time, I cannot claim total objectivity on that basis, since my emotions have become involved in this project. In hearing so many people relate the fascinating experiences with which this volume deals, I have come to feel almost as though I have lived through them myself. I can only hope that this attitude has not compromised the rationality and balance of my approach. Secondly, I write as a person who is not broadly familiar with the vast literature on paranormal and occult phenomena. I do not say this to disparage it, and I feel confident that a wider acquaintance with it might have increased my understanding of the events I have studied. In fact, I intend now to look more closely at some of these writings to see to what extent the investigations of others are borne out by my findings. Thirdly, my religious upbringing deserves some comment. My family attended the Presbyterian Church, yet my parents never tried to impose their religious beliefs or concepts upon their children. They generally tried, as I was growing up, to encourage whatever interests I developed on my own and provided the opportunity for me to pursue them. So, I have grown up having a religion not as a set of fixed doctrines, but rather as a concern with spiritual and religious doctrines, teachings, and questions. I believe that all the great religions of man have many truths to tell us, and I believe that no one of us has all the answers to the deep and fundamental truths with which religion deals. In organizational terms, I am a member of the Methodist Church. Fourthly, my academic and professional background is somewhat diverse, some would say fractured. I attended graduate school in philosophy at the University of Virginia and received my PhD in that subject in 1969. My areas of special interest in philosophy are ethics, logic, and the philosophy of language. After teaching philosophy for 3 years at a university in eastern North Carolina, I decided to go to medical school, and I intend to become a psychiatrist and to teach the philosophy of medicine in a medical school. All these interests and experiences necessarily helped shape the approach I have taken in this study. My hope for this book is that it will draw attention to a phenomenon which is at once very widespread and very well hidden, and, at the same time, help create a more receptive public attitude toward it. for it is my firm conviction that this phenomenon has great significance, not only for many academic and practical fields, especially psychology, psychiatry, medicine, philosophy, theology, and the ministry, but also for the way in which we lead our daily lives. Let me say at the very beginning that, on grounds which I will explain much later, I am not trying to prove that there is life after death. Nor do I think that a proof of this is presently possible. Partly for this reason, I have avoided the use of actual names and have disguised certain identifying details in the stories, while leaving their contents unchanged. This has been necessary, both to protect the privacy of the individuals concerned and, in many cases, to be granted permission to publish the experience related to me in the first place. There will be many who will find the claims made in this book incredible and whose first reaction will be to dismiss them out of hand. I have no room whatsoever to blame anyone who finds himself in this category. I would have had precisely the same reaction only a few years ago. I am not asking that anyone accept and believe the contents of this volume on my authority alone. Indeed, as a logician who disavows that road to belief which proceeds through invalid appeals to authority, I specifically ask that no one do so. All I ask is for anyone who disbelieves what he reads here to poke around a bit for himself. I have issued this challenge repeatedly for some time. Of those who have accepted it, there have been very many who, skeptical at first, have come to share my bafflement over these events. On the other hand, there no doubt will be many who read this and find in it a great relief, for they will discover that they are not alone in having had such an experience. To them especially if, like most, they have concealed their story from all but a few trusted persons, I can only say this: it is my hope that this volume may encourage you to speak a little more freely, so that a most intriguing facet of the human soul may be more clearly elucidated. 1. The phenomenon of death. What is it like to die? That is a question which humanity has been asking itself ever since there have been humans. Over the past few years, I have had the opportunity to raise this question before a sizable number of audiences. These groups have ranged from classes in psychology, philosophy, and sociology through church organizations, television audiences, and civic clubs to professional societies of medicine. On the basis of this exposure, I can safely say that this topic excites the most powerful of feelings from people of many emotional types and walks of life. Yet, despite all this interest, it remains true that it is very difficult for most of us to talk about death. There are at least two reasons for this. One of them is primarily psychological and cultural. The subject of death is taboo. We feel, perhaps only subconsciously, that to be in contact with death in any way, even indirectly, somehow confronts us with the prospect of our own deaths, draws our own deaths closer and makes them more real and thinkable. For example, most medical students, myself included, have found that even the remote encounter with death which occurs upon one's first visit to the anatomical laboratories when entering medical school can evoke strong feelings of uneasiness. In my own case, the reason for this response now seems quite obvious. It has occurred to me in retrospect that it wasn't entirely concern for the person whose remains I saw there, although that feeling certainly figured, too. What I was seeing on that table was a symbol of my own mortality. In some way, if only preconsciously, the thought must have been in my mind, that will happen to me, too. Likewise, talking about death can be seen on the psychological level as another way of approaching it indirectly. No doubt many people have the feeling that to talk about death at all is in effect to conjure it up mentally, to bring it closer in such a way that one has to face up to the inevitability of one's own eventual demise. So, to spare ourselves this psychological trauma, we decide just to try to avoid the topic as much as possible. The second reason it is difficult to discuss death is more complicated, as it is rooted in the very nature of language itself. For the most part, the words of human language allude to things of which we have experienced through our own physical senses. Death, though, is something which lies beyond the conscious experience of most of us because most of us have never been through it. If we are to talk about death at all, then, We must avoid both social taboos and the deep-seated linguistic dilemmas which derive from our own inexperience. What we often end up doing is talking in euphemistic analogies.